Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On the first part of the show, we speak to Paul Carr, who co-authored a book with Darren Lund called The Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, and Identity in Education. I quote, "If white people do not know they are white, how can those who are in positions of power, many of whom are white, effectively understand and challenge racism and unearned privilege?" On the second part of the show, we speak to John Elmer from Amman, Jordan, about Canada's ongoing mission in Afghanistan. He debunks myths about Canada's military role in the world and speaks about how Canada has adopted the strategy of the three-block war. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to have Paul Carr. He is my guest. Paul Carr is a well-known author. He's published extensively one of his latest books, Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, and Identity is one of his books. He actually has some more recent books, including Youth, Culture, Education, and Resistance, Confronting Commercialization and Neoliberalism. And another one that's just coming out, Les Faces Cachées de l'État. I hope I pronounced that properly, which is a work in collaboration with Gina Tissé. The culmination of his years of work has been a wonderful book titled Democracy and Critical Pedagogy. That's your vote count. Very privileged to have Paul Carr. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good. Thank you, Sylvia. Thanks for having me.
Now, as an instructor, I mean, you're a teacher, you're a writer, you're a poet. There's so many conversions that influence your writing and in the way in which you seek to understand the world. You know, in our society today, there is a meta-narrative about what our society is like. How has race and the perpetuation of racial inequality contribute to this system of inequality that plagues every aspect of society today?
You know, you mentioned a few things that I do or I'm interested in, but the reality is that there's hundreds of aspects that define us. Are our parents immigrants? Are we from divorced families? What are our siblings? What are our ideology? Do we have religious affiliations? Who are our friends? What do we do? Then you layer on ethnicity and gender and sexual orientation, and the reality is that, you know, we're complex human beings, although we live in communities, and yet in the media, you know, traditionally, and it's a bit more nuanced now, but often we speak of things such as the quote-unquote the black community, the Latino community. We never really speak of the white community because most people would find that offensive and ridiculous, and of course that couldn't exist. And so often we've chosen this racial marker to define people, and it's been quite offensive and deleterious, and we see that we've structured our society based on racial lines. Now, of course, there's a lot of examples where we have interracial relationships and we function interracially and we you know, consider things in a fair and decent way, and a lot of people work towards change and social justice. But the whole point behind the whiteness phenomenon or understanding whiteness, it's about power and privilege. So it's not so much that, you know, we frequent people, for example, in Toronto, over 50% of the kids in the schools are non-white. And so there's a lot of visible diversity. It's more the power relationship. What does that mean? You know, we know about 15% of the teachers are non-white. It doesn't mean that the white teachers are not good, not sensitive, not able, and so on, but it just means we have to look at issues of power. And the media really has brought this to the fore because most people get most of their information through the mainstream media, although there are many very relevant and excellent outlets like your the one that you've developed, Democracy Now! And others, and lots of things that people are doing through social media. But the reality is that most teachers and most students receive these mass media block messages about people, and we make a lot of decisions based on that. And often the questions we raise don't include, you know, I don't want to take this too far, but should we have a ministry of peace rather than a ministry of defense or a ministry of war? So who are we having these conflicts with? Are they always brown people? So it's bringing that into the fore. You know, the media is pretty homogenized. The mass media is corporately owned, so although there are many hundreds of newspapers and radio stations and television stations, they're essentially owned by three or four or five conglomerates that have the same interests based on stock values and so on. And so we have the same message, and it's striking when you see that, you know, how it's corporately controlled in Canada and the U.S. and elsewhere. And it doesn't mean that we don't have access to other outlets, but, you know, in some of the teaching that I've done in the States, I'm coming back to Canada now, but it's interesting how students at the graduate level, virtually none of them had heard of Noam Chomsky or Democracy Now, or, you know, a critical interrogation of, you know, the U.S. military apparatus around the world. And those are just some starting points, but when you break that down at the racial level, to talk about whiteness, we do have a fear, you know, at a societal level. Blackness seems to be the greatest fear. But, you know, one of the students said to me the most segregated day of the week in the United States is Sunday, when people go to their own churches.
As you're speaking about the questions we ask and don't ask, and as I'm learning in school, is that the question you ask is as important as the answer you're getting. And the questions that go unasked are perhaps the most salient things that describe our own history in a society that's racialized, that's class-based. We were speaking with Paul Street, and he was talking about how there's this new caste that's being formed in the U.S. We're talking about reparations now, he says, but we're not talking about how the military and the prison system has created a new caste system, those who are being targeted with criminal records for a number of things, you know, sometimes very petty crimes. And this new form of racialization and discrimination not only creates more barriers for them. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think we can't talk about social justice without addressing the entrenched inequality that exists in society. What does it mean to have 500 years of colonization, and what role has power played in creating the structures that legitimize, normalize, and maintain social inequality?
On the one hand, with this neoliberal kind of infusion into our thinking, we're taught that, you know, that materialism and individualism are the ultimate virtues. That's what underpins our society. And yet, most, you know, philosophies or religions or thinking people, you know, there has to be a sense of community. And this is one of the debates in education. Is it about getting a job, you know, kind of the neoliberal function, or is it about building a better citizenship, a more engaged, enlightened, critically engaged populace? But getting back to the issue of people, how they're disenfranchised through colonialism and slavery and so on, we arrive at the table with different forms and levels of cultural capital. And so when slavery ended, so to speak, or, you know, then it morphed into other forms of segregation and so on, it wasn't as though white society said, well, you've built, you know, our bridges, our roads, our homes, our agricultural base, our economic base, therefore we're going to reward you and give you everything that you've done. No, they started on the very bottom. And so you can see that in the United States, for example, that not all, but most cities have large, minoritized, marginalized populations of color. There's, you know, higher levels of poverty and crime and so on. And so the notion, and as well, that Ogbu was talking about is this resistance, cultural resistance to schooling and education, that it's for whites. This dates back to that notion that education and educational structures and power were more for whites. So if you bring it into something that maybe we could all relate to, because it's very easy for, you know, for people to say, well, that wasn't me, that was my great-grandfather and so on. A lot of private schools, private golf clubs, private associations and so on, all were based on color. And there were other markers, too, and Jewish people often prohibited, and women. But the reality is that it's very recent that a lot of these private clubs that then formed the elites and the power structures have been open to a certain degree. Even in the last 20 years or 15 years ago, maybe it was only 10 years ago when Tiger Woods won the Masters tournament, the golf tournament, some of his colleagues were joking, well, they better get fried chicken in the clubhouse now. And I do want to make it clear, though, that we're not talking about a comment. It's not, the N-word doesn't mean, you know, that, you know, this is characterizes the state of racism. It is about power. So when you look at education, who develops the curriculum and to what end? And, you know, we have a mythology that North America, per se, it's a white continent, or, you know, Canada's a white country. It's a Christian country. It's a good country. And yet that's all based on the notion that we wiped out 20,000 years of Aboriginal civilization.
We don't think about the ongoing genocide of culture, right, of indigenous people. Over 500 years of colonization and the hundreds of millions of people that were massacred and displaced in order for this land to be settled by newcomers, right? You know, that also translates into real material wealth that is ignored. When we think of Bill Gates, we think of someone who is outstanding, exceptional, and that's why he's a billionaire. We don't think of a legacy of privilege that comes behind it. So can you talk a little bit about that significance of merit, you know, in the context of how our society is organized and how we justified the abject poverty of the majority of people worldwide, and we legitimize the plundering of a few?
Well, I think this is one of the pivotal points about whiteness, and it's a very difficult concept, because you can be a good person, a decent person. You can go to church, you can help out in your community, you can have sentiments of compassion and kindness. You can be good, there can be that goodness, but you can also be racist. One of the examples I like to use in teaching is that if we wanted to stop or end or decrease violence against women, abuse against women, and so on, and sexism, it would almost be, I wouldn't say irrelevant, but it would almost be futile to just work with women and just talk with women and just, you have to involve men. They are the major part of that equation. And so if we wanted to decrease or diminish racism, we have to bring white people into this equation. Often the way that we've studied racism and racialization is to look at what George Day would say is the pathological dysfunctionality of these racialized communities, and not look at the people that they're interacting with. This neoliberal hegemony is really important, because meritocracy up until recently meant that to get a job in government, the private sector, banks, universities, up until very recently, you had to be a white person. So if you were a person of color, an Aboriginal person, other identities, you're not going to be able to, you know, get in with the group or the old boys network or to advance. And this is why it's very interesting with the recent pronouncements of the federal government in relation to the census, and everyone should have a chance and so on. At one level, it's humorous, but it's also pathetic that we can think honestly that we are a colorblind society, when if you look at some of the data on who's in prison or where the police are or racial profiling or so on. And so I guess the point I would like to make is that it's not necessarily an individual thing that you or I or someone else were racist or not racist. It's a systemic collective. When I leave my home, people look at me, I'm related to in a certain way because of various things, including my racial origin. And this is a major feature of our society. Who reads the news on the national news casts and so on, decision-making, voting. And when you look at all these things in relation to democracy, it is a phenomenon. For example, with Obama's election, the majority of whites did not vote for him. And you have to go over this many times to break it down, but, you know, he did win, but 35% of people didn't vote. But the majority of whites didn't vote for him. And the question is, will he be effective? Can he do what he said he would do, and so on? And I'm not sure if you want to pursue that now, but neoliberalism really has curtailed, I think, you know, if you look at the 2 years of speeches before the election and now the 18 months after the election, it would be difficult to say that, you know, he's really made a major improvement for marginalized or people of color in general. And I don't want to slight, you know, his capabilities and so on. And he has been a role model at many levels, and people around the world have a lot of hope and inspiration. It is disheartening to see that some of the directions that he's taken, you know, and if you look at major writers, theorists, and critics, a lot of people frame it as kind of a Bush light transformation, if that's the word for it.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the election of Barack Obama, because we are told that democracy is the solution to the problems we face of inequality or racial inequality worldwide. When I look at the world, particularly Latin America, I would agree that trade agreements are extremely racist. You know, they're posed in a way that favor the U.S., and at the expense of the needs of the local governments, we're asked to produce crops for commodities at the expense of sacrificing being able to produce food for the local communities. You know, the NAFTA agreement is a prime example of how the entire fabric of Mexico society, the ejidos, the local lands that were held in as a commons, were removed and people are being displaced. So there's this whole historical context of incredible plundering that goes ignored. So can there be hope in the era of neoliberalism for a real transformative change?
Yeah, I think that we have to have hope. You know, it's got to be more than you know, a label or a bumper sticker or a campaign slogan. That there's a lot of hope, because there's a lot of people doing things like you're doing today and in general, and a lot of people are doing a lot of things. Unfortunately, we don't see that in the mainstream media. If you tie in, for example, $1 billion being spent on security for G20 in Toronto, you know, which is really phenomenal. The hundreds of thousands of people there and around the world, millions of people who have legitimate concerns with the G20, with these leaders, with so-called electoral representative democracy. None of that was portrayed in the media. It was all based on five people who broke some windows at Starbucks and so on. And then if you tie that in, earlier you said about asking questions. Well, one of the questions would be, how can the federal government now, 2 weeks later, say that it's protecting people's freedom through this census debate, you know, curtailing the amount of data? On the one hand, we might say, well, what's the reason? We don't want to know, for example, how many people of color there are, how many Francophones, what the needs are, because if we don't know, and that's one of the issues, then we can say, look, we're doing a good job, we're very coherent and diverse. But if you tie that in with, there was certainly a curtailing of rights and information and so on with the G20, these things are very germane and relevant. About democracy in particular, I think that, and that's the focus of the work I've been looking at for the last little while, is that I don't think democracy has a lot to do with elections. And yet, almost everything we do and say, focus groups, marketing, campaign, campaigning, fundraising, spending $5 billion on the last U.S. presidential election and so on, we really defocus. It's a very disengaging, disenfranchising process. Democracy, I think, should have a lot more to do with education and critical engagement and critical inquiry. And you can't have a democracy and have 80,000 people, homeless people, living in the streets of Los Angeles, and young people who have a life expectancy of up to 25 because they're, you know, they're in street gangs, and then giving CEOs $1 billion bonuses and so on. I think all those things have to be raised. We spend far too much time thinking about, you know, who's going to get elected and polling and, you know, restricting various groups. A lot of people may not be aware that the Green Party had an African-American woman candidate, an excellent candidate, in the last federal election, but nowhere to be seen, not in the mainstream media and so on. And this is important because a lot of people have just dropped out of this kind of electoral foray. They believe, you know, as Chomsky says, that it's a game for the elites. And notwithstanding Obama's victory and so on, essentially he played the same game with the focus groups, the marketing, raising money, raised a lot of money from corporate interests. And one statistic that's interesting is that the media led us to believe that everyone was engaged. The whole of the United States was consumed and ingratiated and supportive of that electoral campaign. In 2004, 64% of Americans voted in the U.S. election, federal presidential election, in which Bush won. In 2008, when Obama won, it was 65%. So a very, very minor difference, you know, increase in the number of people who supported. And so I think the media has a large role to play, and this is why I believe in the relation to hope, education at various levels, not just the formal, but political literacy, media literacy, critical engagement, the work of Paulo Freire and critical pedagogues like Joe Kinchlow and others, but deconstructing the media. And it's not to say, you know, the media, there isn't anything good and so on, but it can be really deleterious and harmful to not critique these media messages. And I think this is why a lot of, you know, you see a lot of things that in relation to young adolescent girls, you know, in relation to racial origin or obesity, there's a lot of things happening that are outside of the purview of the mainstream media and people's lived experiences. And so when you talk to people kind of from working class backgrounds and so on, sometimes there's a sense that the system isn't made for them, although the American or Canadian dream presents this image. I do want to, if I can just come back to the book, to just one point. The reason that we wrote the book, and you may have covered this in an earlier show, was essentially, calling it The Great White North, was because Darren and I, you know, in talking about it, believe that there's this notion in Canada that our identity is that we're better than the people to the south. Mm-hmm. We're less racist, we're friendlier, we're better and kinder. And so when you look through the racial history of Canada, the internment of the Japanese and the Sikh refugees left offshore and not accepting Jewish refugees during the Second World War and the Chinese on the railroad and the history with Aboriginal peoples and the rising of Africville and so on. And if you go through all of that, the immigration and so on, Canada has a very racialized history. It's not to say, you know, once again, that there aren't good people and good things and good features to our society, but it's a very underplayed narrative. And I think anyone, in some of the research that I've been doing over a number of years from my doctoral work and even before that, and talking to people about these specific issues of race and racialization and so on, I've never met someone of color, a person who's not white, who has said to me, you know, that's off base. That's not mm-hmm. true. I mean, that's not the way it is. Mm-hmm. No, you know, we don't have to agree on every point. The point that I'm making is that people of color in general have a different lived experience than white people. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it's always an entirely bad experience, but there is a recognition that racial discrimination does exist. Whereas when you're talking to white people, and, you know, through the book and through other, you know, presentations and lectures and so on, a lot of white people are offended by this very debate. So I think that the reality is about hope is that we should have hope and we should work for change, but we shouldn't necessarily accept these mainstream narratives and hegemonic inspirations as the gospel. And I think that's where the hope lies, is that a lot of people can and are doing some very interesting things.
Thank you so much for being with us. Now, your book does address the way individual privilege is institutionalized and the perversiveness of whiteness from a variety of standpoints. To me, it's a wonderful resource for people wanting to create awareness, but also open spaces for understanding. You know, we can't move forward if we're always doing if we keep doing what we've been doing for the last 500 years or so, right? And if we keep dividing ourselves. In closing, what inspires you to keep going? It seems to me, especially now with the election of Barack Obama, the discourse on race has almost been closed out. It's, you know, people feel we're equal and, you know, we're all equal now, so let's just move forward and forget about the past, but let's not redistribute that wealth that was accumulated on inequality. Let's not, you know, do any of that. So how do you find inspiration when you face with all this, you know, all these barriers?
Yeah, I think that the notion of colorblindness has really been a very harmful, destructive feature to the whole debate, because we're not colorblind. We're human beings. We're not gender blind. If we were gender blind, we wouldn't have male and female bathrooms, for example, washrooms. We'd only have one. We wouldn't have all kinds of women's magazines and so on. So we're people, and, you know, people have different interests. Now, by saying that, it doesn't mean that it's always negative and so on. But I think to start with this notion that we're colorblind, when clearly Tater and Henry at York University have done some good work on democratic racism, when you look at the history of the legal system and critical race theory of how minorities have been treated, that's not colorblind. If you look at the division in social class, in power, in who controls positions and so on, that's not colorblind. If you look at the way the news media is structured, manufactured, developed, how they editorialize, how do we choose the stories that we see every night on the news? Is that colorblind? Now, it's not to say there isn't good work being done, but it's to say that we should critique and move forward. In relation to my inspiration, I'm human like everyone else, and I try to associate myself with people who are working in similar areas. And I've met some very good people, some wonderful people in the area of critical pedagogy. As I mentioned, Joel Kinchlow, unfortunately, who passed away, was very influential. And there's many people working with Paulo Freire's work who are doing good work, and we don't hear about them. And often even academic books are fairly marginalized. But there are a lot of good things happening, and in schools there's a lot of good work being done. It's interesting how often we kind of have the sense that the whole world is, you know, dancing to the beat of this American hegemonic drum. But I think the narratives that people have, just normal, ordinary people, are very important and inspiring. And education, you know, the way I think now is different than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I think that's the hope for all of us.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/LatinWavesMedia.